Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. In this first hour this morning, we'll be talking about addiction, about addictive diseases and recovery, what it means for individuals, what it means for families. And our guest is someone who is quite well known as someone who works in the field of addiction medicine. His name is Paul Early. He is the medical director of the Talbot Recovery Campus that's located in Atlanta, Georgia, and has written many articles and does a lot of speaking on the subject of addictions. Before taking up the job that he has now, he worked as the medical director of the Impaired Professionals Program and service director of adult addiction medicine at the Ridgeview Institute. Now, that's also in Atlanta. He's been working now for 20 years in this area, and he specializes in long-term therapy and advocacy for professionals who suffer from addictive diseases. He's joining us this morning by telephone, and as we talk, questions certainly are welcome. The only thing we ask of callers is that people just try to be brief in their comments, just so we can keep moving and get in as many callers as possible. But certainly anyone who is listening is welcome to call. If you're in Champaign-Urbana, where we are, the number is 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line, and that's good anywhere that you can hear us. If you're listening over the air or you're listening on the Internet in the United States, you may use that number. That's 800-222-9455. So again, the local number is 333-9455, and the toll-free is 800-222-9455. At any point here, if you have questions, comments, you're certainly welcome to call. Dr. Early, hello.
Hey.
Thanks for talking with us.
Yeah, good to be with you.
You know, it seems that within our popular culture, we talk about addiction a lot. We talk about people who have substance abuse issues with things that are legal or illegal. We talk about people who are addicted to shopping and addicted to sex, and we even talk about being a country that's addicted to oil. And I wonder whether all that addiction talk, I think it maybe might say one of two things. Either it would say we understand addiction very well, or that we maybe don't really understand it at all. And I'm wonder, could in fact be one of the other those things be true?
Absolutely. I think that in some ways both are true. First of all, I think it's common in the popular culture now to understand people, for instance, that have alcohol dependence, and to understand that there are some people that when they drink, they can't control their drinking, they get out of control, they have problems with family difficulties and that sort of thing. So that part is true, that in general the knowledge base, what people understand about addiction, is improving. On the other hand, the other side is also true a little bit, David, that is to say, the little bit of knowledge that people are getting about alcohol dependence or other drug dependencies are tending to make people talk about other behaviors as being addictive when they really are not quite that way. In other words, there's a lot of different behaviors that would people do. If someone goes to the mall and you know, spends too much on clothes one day and they don't have a pattern of doing that, they start branding it as addiction. And that actually, unfortunately, trivializes the problem when it really is problematic in someone's life, i.e., meaning it takes over their whole world. So both are true, I think, that we know more about addiction, that the general, in general, people that come into treatment with us, or when I educate people in public forums, their questions they ask indicates that they understand a lot more about it. And then the other part's true as well, that that maybe it's becoming a little trivialized by people kind of flippantly saying, you know, I must be addicted to shopping when in times they're not. That having been said, I do want to say there are people that really do have severe shopping addictions. By that I mean they literally will spend all of their money, bankrupt themselves, that sort of thing. But the numbers of people that have that type of illness are very few. That sort of thing. So
I think that it is true that we have come to some way in understanding that chemical dependencies and some of the other things that we're talking about are, in fact, diseases, that addiction is a disease. At the same time, it seems that we have a difficult time letting go of the idea that this is somehow also a moral failure.
Yes. But and I think that's because of several things. First of all, that it is an illness that exists in the brains of some people. That is to say, especially it's very clear. Let's talk right now just about the chemical addictions. Mm-hmm. That the brain biochemistry is very specific. We're beginning to understand it very clearly. We're even being able to, more recently, there's some medications which seem to help stem the tide of addiction or prevent relapse. But what happens is how the disease presents itself is by people's behavior, and the behaviors are very are things which can be judged using a moral compass. People who become alcoholic tend to, lose their ability to maintain monogamous relationships in marriage, or they begin to lie, or they begin to even do illegal behaviors that they would never think of doing when they're not actively involved in their alcohol or drug dependence. And so it's very easy to apply, if you will, the moral value judgment to it. And one of the things that we say in the addiction world is how we can tell if someone needs to be jailed versus needing treatment has to do with when do the behaviors occur? Is it part of the chemical illness that the behaviors that appear to be moral failures occur? And if it does occur at that time, then oftentimes getting the individual into recovery, and that's different than not drinking or using drugs. There's a different state called recovery. When people get in recovery, those behaviors stop. And the individuals that maybe embezzled some money from work, they feel awful about it. They often are very willing to make amends for their behavior, pay the money back, even do jail time. A lot of our patients would say if they did something illegal, when they're sitting in jail, they say, I deserve to be here for a while for what I've done. So that's not a sign of a moral failure. Rather, that's a sign of the person that has ethical values which are correct, actually.
I think sometimes we also tend to talk about dependency in two ways, as if there were two different kinds, as if there were something that clearly is physiological, which when you talk about chemical dependency, it's probably a little bit easier for people to understand and grasp that idea. And then we also talk about psychological dependency.
Right.
And is that really in fact two different things, or is that really one thing?
Yeah. Wow, that's a great question. And to answer that, if you don't mind, I'm going to tell you a little bit about the history of our understanding of addiction, because this is a helpful thing.
Mm-hmm.
There are certain chemicals that human beings take that have long been seen as addicting chemicals, and the archetypal one is alcohol, used in our culture really since the beginning of time. Even in very early hunter and gatherer cultures, there's evidence that they learned how to brew primitive beer and that sort of thing. So we've been using chemicals to alter our mood throughout our history of Homo sapiens, and some of those chemicals produce a physiologic dependence which is detectable using very simple instruments. So, for instance, if someone drinks alcohol every day and develops a physiologic dependence, that was your first term, which is a great one, then they wind up, their blood pressure goes up, they get the sweats or the chills, they sometimes have seizures during the withdrawal. So the physiologic dependence, you can point at it, you can see it, very simple instruments can detect it. And so medicine was able to say this causes physical dependence. And actually, right around, say, in the 1950s, the thinking at the time was that in order to produce addiction, a chemical also had to produce physiologic dependence. And those chemicals were primarily the opiate drugs, morphine, heroin, those sorts of things, and then alcohol. And then along comes in our culture the drug that turned everything, fruit basket turnover, completely changed how we looked at things, and that was really cocaine. When cocaine rolled into our culture, and this, by the way, this was the second cocaine epidemic. There was a more minor cocaine epidemic at the turn of the century in the United States. But when the second cocaine epidemic, so to speak, hit the United States, what we learned about that is that here was a drug that we couldn't detect with simple instruments any physiologic dependence, yet no one would argue that the addiction to it was not severe and life-threatening. People were dying, people were acting crazy, they were, you know, they were robbing grocery stores to get money for more crack. You know, it clearly created the same types of addiction behavior, yet it, if you went to a physician and said, what are the withdrawal symptoms of cocaine, he would say, there are none. And the reason that was said was because the withdrawal symptoms for a drug like cocaine are in the brain. The brain, the craving symptoms that they have, the compulsive urges, which are almost impossible to resist when someone is actively using, those are things which defy, a blood pressure cuff can't detect them, or they defy this concept of physiologic dependence. The physiology that changes, if you will, is in the head. It's in the brain. And so, actually, it does create a type of a dependence phenomenon, but it is limited to the brain. And so this is what we're learning, is that this phenomenon of physiologic dependence is not related to this phenomenon called addiction. There are some addicting drugs that produce severe physiologic dependence all of the drugs that create physiologic dependence create addiction. But some drugs that create no physiologic dependence can be just as severe, if not worse, in terms of their addiction profile. They're two separate processes, if you will. And that's a kind of an important distinction that we learned, really, as soon as we had to start taking care of people that were severely addicted to cocaine, because they would come in, you know, a couple days later without really any medication, they would appear to be fine. You know, if you would check their blood pressure, check their pulse, check their pupils, to see if they were sweating, or there would be no physiologic problems. Yet if you took a look at what was going on in their brain, you could tell that it clearly was not normal, that the brain had shifted into this addicted state.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580 is Dr. Paul Early. He's the medical director of the Talbot Recovery Campus in Atlanta, Georgia. He has written many articles, does a lot of speaking across the country on the subject of addictions. He works with all types of addictive disorders, including chemical addictions, things like alcohol and drugs, also gambling dependence and sexual compulsivity. And we're talking about addiction, and questions certainly are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. I'm thinking about your comment that, as far as we know, going back a long way into human history, that people were using mood-altering substances, and the chances are probably the first one was alcohol, and I'm sure, though, over time people found a lot of other things, which would say that the something about the makeup of the brain was just almost waiting. And as I understand it, what happens is once the brain or some part of the brain are introduced to these substances, and you'll forgive me if I'm vastly oversimplifying, but the way I understand it is it's as if that part of the brain says, hey, I like that, let's have some more of it. And that then the people will seek that out. If that indeed is kind of what we're talking about here, then it seems that we're fighting a very old kind of tendency and a very old kind of behavior in human beings. Now, that's not saying, I'm not suggesting that we should just give up, but I'm saying, well, does that not really make this task extremely difficult?
Yeah, it does. And I don't think you're vastly oversimplifying. Actually, that's a great description. I think you did a great job of kind of capturing the essence of it. What it is the there's several parts of the brain that are organized around very important functions, and if a function is really critical to survival of the human being, it will trigger what we perceive of today in modern society as reward. And there in the brain, there is one reward center. It's a series of structures deep within the brain, and actually even in more primitive animals. And what the drugs are, the drugs that are addicting, what they do is they hijack the traditional reward system, And some people, that we haven't quite figured out what it is, it's a combination of genetics and families and emotional situations, that sort of thing. Some people are more susceptible to this hijacking, if you will. So let's say you're an individual that you drink alcohol, and you're in college, and you're, which probably would be applicable to your city, and you've got five college kids at a bar on a Saturday night sharing a pitcher of beer. One of those people has a, you know, because 10% of the American population has a probability of, will become chemically dependent in their lifetime. This is a common illness, very common illness. And so one of those kids has a good chance of being alcohol dependent. How they respond to the alcohol early on is going to be different. They're going to, it's going to light up their reward center more strongly. Their brain will make a note of that. It'll say, this was an important event that occurred. Versus other people will say, yeah, I went out with my buddies and I had had a couple glasses of beer and it was, we had a good time. We just talked and laughed and it was a good social situation. That one individual, it will trigger an area of the brain called the nucleus accumbens to say, something important just happened here. And you will remember that. So when my patients come into treatment and I say, do you remember the first time you ever drank alcohol? They say, yes, I remember. It was a Saturday night. I was in college, freshman year. I was at a party, blah, blah, blah. And they can tell you the whole story because something is triggered in them that says, this is important. And we don't know what that difference is in those individuals. But the reward system that hijacks is a really – it's part of this – it's what has kept us alive. The reward system also mediates other things, such as staying out of danger, creating a safe situation. In our modern society, we perceive of this as rewards, such as getting a raise at work or having a boss say you did a good job. Or it also has to do with safety. So if you're at home with your spouse and they say to you, I love you very much, and I'm so happy that we have created this safe home for our children, just a little bit of a reward response will occur in the brain. So all of the things that our society is organized around that produces rewards, this nucleus accumbens is responsible for signaling in the brain, this is important, this is a reward. And in the alcoholic individual, that area seems to be triggered very strongly by certain substances. And those substances are the drugs that people get addicted to. Hmm.
And so the fact that in some people that this could happen, the substances could hijack this reward system, and that you could actually get into a situation where people would ignore everything else in order to satisfy that need, could even recognize that this was self-destructive behavior and continue to do it. The fact that that mechanism works at that way, it sounds as if it's just an accident. In a sense, that's just an accident of the way the brain is wired up.
Right, and exactly. And you said it very, very clearly that it takes over other parts. It makes people can even recognize, I think I'm in trouble here with this drinking, but they say it's too important to me. Other people say the drinking or maybe the using of the cocaine or the using the OxyContin or the taking of the heroin or the smoking of the marijuana or the methamphetamine, they say, you know, this is, they can't see it, but some people can actually recognize that they're in trouble, and the reward is strong enough that they literally will, the other things that are important in life, taking care of family, job, health, staying out of trouble, those sorts of things go by the wayside, and that's what happens. So this is where this idea, I think, gets us in line with this, where people get in trouble with it. Well, people make a choice to drink, don't they? That's what people say to me. How can it be a disease? Because people choose to drink a glass of wine. They make a choice, right? And I say, at first, that's true. What happens with people that are alcohol dependent, for instance, is early on, they may drink a glass of wine and make a volitional choice to have a glass of wine. And then at some point, literally, the reward process starts overwhelming the choice area of the brain, and it moves from being a choice to a compulsion, and that's when you become addicted to the substance. And that's where, when you have this kind of Nancy Reagan idea of just say no, that doesn't work in people that are chemically dependent. The just say no is only a preventative measure in people who might be at risk, or people who, before they have chosen to use chemicals. And unfortunately, in our society, the numbers of people that use no mood-altering chemical, and I'm talking about no nicotine, no caffeine, no alcohol, no pills, no Xanax, no Valium, no, it's very small. So you're exposing a large population to the risky substances.
Our guest, again, in this part of Focus 580 is Dr. Paul Early. He is nationally known for working in the field of addiction medicine. He's medical director of the Talbot Recovery Campus in Atlanta, Georgia. He is published author of the Cocaine Recovery Book and the Cocaine Recovery Workbook. And if you're interested in finding out more about him, you can go to the website of Talbot, or maybe it's your website, earlyassociates.com.
Actually, you should use the TalbotRecovery.com.
Okay.
It's called TALBOTT Campus, CAMPUS.com.
All right. Yeah. So if people want to find out more about Talbot, they can do that. And we have several people here who'd like to get in on the conversation, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. And we'll start out with someone here where we are in Champaign County, and this is line one. Hello.
Hi. You got around to mentioning nicotine, and it seems it's the most explicitly, you don't have to learn the pattern. It's explicitly addictive, and I don't know if that makes it an easier case to talk about or harder. I'm particularly concerned about the treatment that's going around. It's the most heavily complained about, and I guess there's some kind of cluster of suicides involved in the use, and I can't remember the name. It starts with a CH or something. That, you know, one would need to have a fairly good longitudinal study to find out whether the people that, you know, had problems with it were already inclined to have problems and part of their quote-unquote addictive personality, which you've kind of undercut earlier. But can you sort that out, starting, I guess, with what the clinical results are? I've also run into people who have had good success with using the
Chantix.
Chantix,
yeah. Great. Well, I like what you said about the fact that nicotine is certainly an incredibly addicting substance. In some ways, someone said to me the other day, we arrived in this country and the Indians gave us nicotine, and in some ways they showed us how to culture, how to grow nicotine and tobacco plants. And we've been living with that ever since. And so the person said that to me, said, well, in some ways we kind of probably deserved it for what we did to them. But I do want to say that nicotine is a very addicting substance. It is one of the things that's interesting about nicotine is its effects on the mood are more subtle, so that one can be severely addicted to nicotine and function in everyday life. As most nicotine users, they're driving cars, they're flying airplanes, they're making critical decisions about our economy, there's no aspersions there. The point is that nicotine's a really addicting drug, yet its effects on mood are subtle enough that you can literally be addicted to the drug and not be terribly impaired in your day-to-day life at first. The other part is about nicotine. Nicotine dependence kills more people than alcohol and drug dependence, wars, famines, AIDS combined internationally. So there's no doubt that nicotine is a huge problem, and that we in the United States need to do more about helping people get better from it. So nicotine's a problem, and the treatment is probably we're not doing enough about that. The drug Chantix is a very effective drug in terms. It is the other two medicines that we've had before is a medication called bupropion which was fairly effective, and then the nicotine patches, which are also fairly effective. But Chantix also seems, in well-controlled studies, Chantix helps people stop smoking. It's about 1.8 times more effective than the next best drug, which is going to be nicotine patches, and the bupropion, which is a trade name of Wellbutrin. So Chantix is a good drug. Now, are there some downsides to it? Yes, there is some definite downsides to it. For reasons we don't understand, in some segment of the population, it worsens depression. And the data on exactly who is at risk is not clear. So a physician can't say to you, you fulfill these five criterion, so I can't prescribe Chantix for you because these are the criterion which place you at risk. And so we don't quite understand that. And when just like any drug, when it's used on a large population, there's unfortunately going to be side effects. And the side effects from Chantix were very scary. But the drug is effective enough, so that the most important thing to do when someone's considering using Chantix is to first of all to screen for depression. If there is significant depression already, you want to avoid Chantix, or you want to do it in a controlled environment. So, for instance, down here at Talbot, when we help someone stop smoking as part of their addiction treatment, if they have a history of depression, it doesn't stop us from using the medication. We just observe them more carefully. But we are a residential treatment center, and we can watch that, and your physician can't be with you all day long. So I would say that with Chantix, it's an effective drug. It is by far the most effective drug we have so far, and can be used in combination with the other medications to help people stop smoking. But there are some significant risks, and what you have to do is counsel people. I often think a good thing to do is to tell not only if I'm going to have a husband who comes in who wants to stop smoking, give him the Chantix. You also talk to the husband's patient's wife and say, if you notice your husband getting moody or irritable, your contract with me is that he will stop taking the Chantix immediately and call me up, and we'll come up with a plan B. There are some risks with it, and it's not a perfect drug. I wish I could say that it was, but unfortunately there are not many medications that don't have a side effect, and the right thing to do is to counsel and be careful with it, like any other drug.
All right. I want to thank the last caller and go on to the next. This is Champagne in line number two. Hello.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
Really great show. I'm really enjoying it. I have a question. I was interested to find out that eating disorders were considered addictive behaviors and that they were treated as such. And it doesn't make a lot of sense to me why that might be, because a person isn't actually ingesting anything that would give them an exhilarating outcome, you know, that would be considered an addictive thing, like a reward. You're talking about the reward center. So it doesn't seem very rewarding to me. So I wondered if you could talk a little bit about that and explain why it's considered an addicting behavior, and I'll hang up and listen.
Thanks. Great. Well, that's a good question. I think the thing, first of all, eating disorders are, there are various different subtypes of eating disorders. The self-starvation eating disorder, which is anorexia nervosa, the binging and purging type of eating disorder, which is called bulimia nervosa, and then there's a whole host of people who are compulsive overeaters that can't stop, can't control their food intake, get sick with that process. I guess the first thing I want to be real clear about is that these are eating disorders are complex disorders, and they are not strictly an addictive process. The way I like to describe it to people is that it's a combination of a medical, a addiction, and a psychological and a sociologic process. Part of the reason, for instance, that women have more problems with anorexia nervosa and bulimia nervosa is the unrealistic expectation, especially coming out of the 60s and the 70s, that women, that whole concept of you can't be too rich or too thin, that sociologic movement, the thin part of that anyway, created a group of people who, the contrast between what was considered beauty, which was an enormous, it was an awfully thin image, in contrast with the average weight of the American female, created a disparity which really fueled that's the sociologic process which fueled the eating disorder. So I want to first of all reiterate that eating disorders are not just simply addictive behaviors, but there is a part of every eating disorder which is indeed addictive. And you, what if in a good comprehensive treatment of an eating disorder, there's a combination of sociologic retraining, psychological therapy, psychiatric therapy, and addictive learning how to handle an addictive process. I'm sorry, I forgot the caller's name. I don't think she identified the name.
Well, we actually did, we don't ask people to give their names.
Okay, so. Great. It was a great question she said about, is it, but it's not rewarding. I say this somewhat tongue-in-cheek, David, but if it's not rewarding, how do you account for all those fine restaurants that we have in Champaign, Illinois, Champaign-Urbana? There is a reward process that occurs with food consumption. And in fact, it is the most primitive and powerful reward reflex. And in fact, research shows that, for instance, high sugary foods that are administered to rats on an intermittent dosing schedule so that they are deprived from high sugar foods and they're given high sugar foods and they're withdrawn and they're given, can induce an eating disorder which is indistinguishable from the problem that plagues a lot of compulsive overeaters in the United States. And when they look at the neurophysiology of that, they find that this same reward center is stimulated. The nucleus accumbens lights up. The satiety center, the center in the brain that says, I'm full and I'm okay and I ate enough, is right next door to the reward center, and is it's actually its counterpart. And a piece of every eating disorder problem is an addictive process. It is not solely an addictive process. And we've had the best success over the years treating people with eating disorders by using a combination of therapies, which includes seeing it as addictive. And the reason you want to see it as addictive is then you can do all kinds of, in our parlance, what's called relapse prevention techniques. You can prevent a relapse into the compulsive food behaviors. And that's why it's helpful to look at it as an addictive disorder. So eating disorders are complicated, but there's a piece of it that's addictive, and it uses the same kind of reward system and is actually, in some ways, the most powerful and primitive reward system. Every time that feeling that you have at the end of a good meal, where you kind of push away from the table and you sit back and you feel calm, centered, you have a nice conversation with the people sitting around with you at the restaurant, that small little glow that you get is actually firing in the nucleus accumbens of a little squirt of dopamine in the brain.
Mm-hmm. Well, I hope that at least touches on the go some way to answer the question of the caller. And I want to continue because the lines are full and we're moving into about our last 15 minutes. So I want to get in at least as many people as we can. And also, I want to introduce again the guest for this hour, Dr. Paul Early. He's the medical director of the Talbot Recovery Campus in Atlanta, Georgia. It's a residential treatment center for people who are addicted to alcohol and other mood-altering chemicals. He has been working now for 20 years in this field, treating addictive diseases. He specializes in the long-term therapy and advocacy for professionals who suffer from addictive diseases and has worked with all types of addictive disorders, including alcohol and drugs, as well as gambling dependence and sexual compulsivity. If you're interested about Talbot, they have a website you can take a look at. And questions here are welcome to 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. And we will talk with someone else here in Bloomington, Illinois, line number 4. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Yes, thank you for this updated information. I had so many questions and thoughts while you're talking, but try to keep it simple. I quit smoking after 34 years, and I reprogrammed myself. But I wouldn't dare touch one because it might set up a physical need. And if I've got that right or wrong, please correct me. But
can I stop you there, ma'am? Because
sure.
I want to say something about that. First of all, congratulations.
Thank you.
And second of all, what you said, I've reprogrammed myself. In some ways, that's a really good way of framing what one has to do to get better. You have to start thinking differently. You had to change your life in some ways, right?
Yeah,
you had to.
I had to read and read and find out all the bad things it was doing to me.
Yes.
Because it definitely was a mood changer.
Right. And then the second thing you said, which was great as well, is the characteristic of an addictive problem is that if you have it, it never goes away, and your wariness about it. I'm not going to let myself smoke just one because I'm concerned I'll be back in that same old place. That is exactly accurate and very true for nicotine-dependent individuals. So congratulations, and how you're thinking about it is perfect. That's exactly right.
Thank you, and I've been a 40-year member, 40-plus year member of AA, so I figured from that that I guess that's where I got it, because that's what happens in AA.
Right.
And I knew from the first drink that I had found home. You know, it just did things to me that, and you hear this over and over, I'm sure. But it didn't take very long for me to become addicted to alcohol. But I'm the most interested in what you said about the physiological part. I didn't really hear all the hijacking part, but you mentioned something about drugs that now maybe can treat people. I would not be interested myself, but I'm sure, you know, generations coming up, it would be extremely helpful. And the other question or thought, well, question would be Ritalin and some of these drugs that are being given to children at very young ages, at what point, I mean, if they're very young, wouldn't that affect a change in the brain that might lead to an addiction or not?
Great.
Thank you.
Okay. I know we're running shorter on time, so I'll try to be a little more brief. We can talk about the, by the way, and congratulations for your time in recovery in AA. The data shows that people who actively participate in Alcoholics Anonymous over a lifetime not only stop drinking alcohol, but their lives become more meaningful.
Yeah.
They also have a lower incidence of other medical problems. They have a lower incidence of stress-related medical problems. They have fewer instances of hypertension. They have fewer. So Alcoholics Anonymous really creates a frame around your life. I'm sure that's been your experience, where you see things from a different angle, and by seeing things from this psychosocial spiritual angle, which is different, literally life seems different, and people tend to do better. There's actually a study now that people are looking at to see if it's a very long-term study to see that Alcoholics Anonymous may actually extend people may actually live longer because of it, which is a fascinating story. So continued attendance at AA is the best prognosis, and sponsoring people in AA helps. If you go to Alcoholics Anonymous meetings and you sponsor other people, you have something like an 87 or 90% probability of not drinking for 5 years or more. So that's an enormously successful program for those that can embrace it.
Yeah.
So that's great. Congratulations. Yeah. Now, as far as the medications go, the medications that are available now are I would love to tell you that they are powerfully effective in all cases, but probably the single most effective medication we have today that decreases alcohol cravings for folks that have alcohol dependence is an injection called Vivitrol. That's the trade name. The generic name is Naltrexone. And believe it or not, that's a drug which blocks what are called the opioid receptors, or the same thing, the morphine receptors in the brain, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
And for reasons that are complicated, but we're actually understanding now, if you block these receptors, it decreases alcohol cravings, And so people have more success in remaining abstinent early on in their recovery. So it's a great tool. The medication alone does not help stop people from drinking. I want to be real clear about that. But when used in concert with various types of therapy, either outpatient therapy, a residential program, AA attendance, that sort of thing, Vivitrol strongly improves the quality, the probability that the individual will remain abstinent from alcohol, and it's a very exciting medication. It's actually a medication that's been around for a while. It's in a different formulation because it's used as a once a month injection. Mm-hmm. So that this naltrexone is really injectable. Naltrexone is a wonderful thing. There's another medication called Camprol. Mm-hmm. That's the trade name, or acamprosate, which is a generic name. And that seems to also help decrease cravings. And neither of these drugs are addicting in themselves, so that you're not trading one addiction for another. Years ago, what people used to think, physicians used to think, that if you have an alcohol problem and people would come and they'd stop drinking, they'd say, now I'm anxious. And they'd say, well, I'll just give you some Valium, and that'll help get rid of your anxiety. And you're laughing because you've seen what happens with those people is they wind up just getting addicted to the Valium, and that doesn't occur with these medications. These are not addicting medications.
We've come a long way from the Keeley Institute.
That's right, exactly. The Keeley Institute. I'm glad you remember that. Right.
Yeah. And can you comment on the possibility of the Ritalin creating in young children?
Yeah, the Ritalin is a psychostimulant, and Ritalin, like any psychostimulant, is abusable and can be addicting. The problem is we have two illnesses which actually, interestingly enough, seem to occur in the same population, and that's attention deficit disorder and addiction problems. Mm. And those two tend to run in the same families, actually. Mm. If you give a large population, let's say you have 100 kids or maybe 200 kids, and they have attention deficit disorder, and you give Ritalin to them, there is a slight increase in the probability that one of those kids will start abusing the Ritalin. That is true.
Mm-hmm. Could it create a physiological difference?
It is one of those drugs that we talked about earlier that does not create, I can't detect it with a blood pressure cuff and that sort of thing. It, just like the cocaine, it creates the changes are in the brain, the hunger, the drug hunger and that sort of thing.
Yeah, okay.
However, so that if you give it to 200 people, a certain percentage of those kids, it increases the risk that they might become chemically dependent.
Uh-huh.
But the opposite effect is actually even stronger. That is to say, that treating attention deficit disorder, and I'll tell you, as an addiction medicine doctor, it makes me very anxious giving kids Ritalin. Yeah. On the other hand, there's only one really good long-term paper that looked at tracking kids over 10, 15 years or more, and they found out that the kids who had severe attention deficit disorder and were not treated had an increased probability of addiction.
Mm-hmm.
It's not what you would think, right?
Oh, yeah.
And the reason you would think that, the theory behind why that happens is kids that have attention deficit disorder, they feel like there's something wrong with them. They feel like there's something wrong inside of them. And they wind up kind of being made fun of a little bit in classes. They have more troubles, and that creates some psychological trauma, if you will, that makes them more susceptible towards alcohol or drug dependence. So what I tell parents is if when they call me up and they say, my son has attention deficit disorder, my doctor wants me to put my child on Ritalin, should I do that? I tell them a couple of things. First of all, I say, is there a family history of addiction? If there is, it's slightly more risky, and you need to know that. But if the attention deficit disorder is severe and it really needs treatment, then it is unfortunately a medication which might decrease the probability of addiction for the psychological reasons. So there's a balance between there. There's no good answer. This is one of the problems with medicine today is we don't have medications which are exactly help the attention deficit disorder in the way where people get better. I think this is an important issue, so I'm taking time talking about it. So there's no black and white answer. Do I worry about giving kids Ritalin because they might become addicted? Absolutely. Do I worry that if kids don't have their attention deficit disorder treated, that they might go on to have develop an addiction problem? Absolutely. So there's no clear answer one way or the other. What I tell parents to do is watch, educate the kids. If you have any indication that they are maybe abusing the Ritalin, then immediately stop it. Talk to your physician. And there are also some newer drugs which have a slightly lower addiction liability, although, again, you have to match the medication with a child.
I hope the caller will forgive me. I certainly appreciate her comments. We just have about 5 minutes left, and I'd like to try to get at least one more caller in the time that remains. And so we will do that, and we'll go on and talk with someone in Champaign, and this is line number 3. Hello.
Yeah, hi. Just a quick, in terms of meth, I've heard that it's, in terms of the reward, that it's the first time the highest reward that one can ever receive. And then after that, it becomes less and less. And is that true, or what accounts a very strong, addiction, that kind of thing? And I'll just go off the air and let you answer. Okay.
Great. Great question as well. Methamphetamine. When you take large doses of methamphetamine, and again, this is the doses that unfortunately are available to most people today because it's relatively inexpensive. The stimulation to the brain is enormous, and it does create a reward response, which is very, very strong. And unfortunately, what happens is when we talked earlier about that kind of signaling in the brain, the nucleus accumbens in the reward center says, this is important, pay attention, this is great. It's driven very hard by methamphetamine, and it is one of the several drugs which is the most addicting of drugs around. It fits in the category of two or three that are up there near the top. Now, what happens with all of the amphetamine, actually every addicting drug, is that you develop tolerance for the reward response. And that's, if you talk to anyone that's become chemically dependent, they'll say, yeah, when I drink now, or when I take the narcotics, or when I take the methamphetamine, it isn't nearly as enjoyable as it was at first, but that doesn't stop me from trying. And that's wherein you get trapped, because people will start taking more and more of the drug and they get more and more sick, and that's very true for methamphetamine. People wind up escalating the dose very strongly, and they get very physically ill. They lose weight, they get infections, their teeth start to have teeth and gum disease. Their brain becomes very toxic from the drug. They don't think very clearly. They neglect their self-care and their child's self-care. So it's a very sad and dangerous drug that has really, unfortunately, become the cocaine of the 70s, if you will. Mm. And but it is very high. Now, I do want to say one other thing about that that's important, is that the stimulation of the brain, what we're talking about is the first use of a drug stimulates something that, in our field, has been known for a long time, called euphoric recall. And when someone that's chemically dependent thinks back on that first use, it induces this very strong response, this driver, reward response, that tends to have them seek it again. And that's really the danger of these drugs. And that's why what you want to do with your children, what you want to do with each other, is don't start.
We're at the point almost where we have to finish. We like to take on complicated subjects on this program, so as a result, it seems most of the time we end up at the end saying, there's so much more, so many things that we didn't get into, and perhaps that means that if you would honor us, you could we could talk again. Just real quick, we know that having someone close to you who has had problems with addiction means that your risk factors go up. Do you think that there is some sort of strong genetic component here, or is that more about what you learn about living life and responding to its challenges just by watching your parents, your brothers and sisters, other people who are close to you?
Another great question, David. I've really enjoyed today, and I'd love to be back anytime. There's absolutely no doubt that when you look at large populations, that the strongest driver that produces people at risk for developing addiction is genetics, not your family you were raised in, but your genes. Mm-hmm. And All of the other factors are important. There are four or five other strong factors that can place you at risk towards developing addiction. But genes are, if you have someone in your family that's chemically dependent, in your biologic family that's chemically dependent, you should be careful about your use of substances which are addicting in nature. And there's just no doubt about that. If you're a parent and you have an alcohol problem and you're in recovery, you should teach your children that they are at higher risk, if they drink alcohol, of being alcoholic. And there's that would be the case even if your child was raised by your a relative or a non-relative down the street, that the genes are very strong and that the genetic tendencies are very clear.
Well, with that, I think perhaps we'll have to stop. If people are interested, by the way, in reading more about the Talbot Recovery Campus in Atlanta, Georgia, where our guest, Dr. Paul Early, is the medical director, you can just put Talbot Recovery Campus into your web browser if you have internet access, or you can go to their website, which is talbotcampus.com, and that's Talbot with, well, actually three T's, T-A-L-B-O-T-T. You could also, if you're interested, look for his book, The Cocaine Recovery Book. He is well known for speaking and writing on the subject of addictions. And Dr. Early, thank you very much for talking with us.
It was good to talk with you too, David. Thanks.